if you're new in the village, my name is Dan Erlander from Albuquerque, New Mexico, and this is number two of a series on the Isaiah School of Theology in Jerusalem, ISTJ. And this will be our last session before the seminary moves to Babylon. Tomorrow morning, the seminary will move to Babylon. Each time before we begin, I want to share something about why I think the study of Isaiah is important. And I like to share that with another reason today. Yesterday, I shared the importance of the similarity between the situation when Isaiah began his preaching. When he began his preaching, a time of just economic growth, prosperity, peace, good times was just coming to a close, and the nation was entered into a period of many, many years of crisis. And Isaiah now comes with the word of the Lord into that situation. I forgot yesterday, and I think it's always important when we look at the prophets, is just to remind ourselves of what we mean by the biblical word prophet or prophecy. Our normal cultural meaning of the word prophet is what? What'd you say? Yeah, right. One who foretells the future, a crystal ball. The biblical understanding of the word prophet would be closer to just changing it a little to foretell. A prophet is a preacher of the word of the Lord into a situation in which that preacher finds himself. The prophet always has a vision of God's future and relates that vision of God's future to the present. But the main task and vocation of a prophet is to preach the word of the Lord in that situation. So in the true sense, today a prophet in the church would not be one that somehow knows the secret of future historical events, but a prophet is one who takes the word of the Lord and proclaims it in the midst of our time and in the midst of our history. Is that clear, the difference between the normal? I think you usually hear this in almost every Bible study, so I don't want to spend a lot of time repeating, but it's important to remind ourselves. Another theme that runs through Isaiah is typical, and this theme matured in the 8th century prophets, Isaiah, then in the Northern Kingdom, Amos and Hosea. And that was the understanding that the God of Israel is not a tribal deity that is mainly kind of our God of our tribe, but rather that Yahweh, the God of Israel, is the Lord of all history. And Yahweh, the God of Israel, is the Lord of all the nations on the earth. He is working through historical events to bring about his purposes for the earth. A tremendous new idea in ancient times, where in ancient times each grouping or tribe or nation thought, well, our God is our God. And if you beat us, that means your God's better than our God, and we'll adopt your God until that God fails, and then we'll move to another God. The tribal deity. The God is Lord of history, and therefore when the covenant is broken by Israel, the God of history will punish Israel. And he will use other nations to punish his people. Assyria is called the rod of my anger. Later Babylon, then the Persian Cyrus will be the servant of Yahweh. These kings and leaders and the historical situation, God is in control and he's using the nations for his purposes. This means that when God wants to use Assyria for a while, he uses Assyria. When God is through with Assyria, he goes, goodbye Assyria. God wants to use Babylon for a while, fine. Then when he's through with Babylon, God wants to use Persia for a while and Cyrus. When he's through with them, it's another psh. God wants to use Russia for a while or the United States, and when he's through, it's psh. You know, that's the way it goes. Why are we so afraid of Russia? Why are we so afraid of Russia? You know, do we believe in a God of history? Question I'd ask. The God of history works judgment on the earth. I want to say a word about how I personally have come to see history. And I think this relates to the book of Isaiah. I think this is a prophetic way to understand history, and I may be all wrong. And I don't want to force this on anyone. I want to invite you maybe to struggle with this. But I think we have been living in good times economically now for many years. And through my own journey into the issues, these good times have been built upon the hunger and the oppression of most of the world. And to believe in a God of history is to believe in a God that does not sit there and say, that's okay, that can go on forever, but there's a time when the God of history says, stop. And I believe that you can feel the change in the world today, that the God of history is saying, enough, Western world. Enough of ripping off my world as millions and even billions of people are hungry. The God of history says, I won't take it anymore. And I believe we're moving into a time of history when there will be much trouble for us, and there will be two reactions to this. And I'm not saying here at this point to say let's all be tremendously guilty and see if we can stop it. I don't think anything can stop the judgment of God. The judgment of God is coming. There are two ways to respond, and there'll be two ways as the coming years come upon us. Some people will be on the floor throwing tantrums, you know, because things are not good anymore. A remnant of people of faith will be dancing in the midst of God's judgment, saying God does judge, but he's bringing a new thing. And I think it's the invitation, and I see that as the rest of my ministry as a preacher of the gospel in the next, I'm planning to be a preacher of the gospel for 30 more years, and then I'm going to die. Or something, or some other way to kind of phase out. But I see that as a task of proclamation, and it's pastoral to help people understand the prophetic God of history who is acting in our history. And when harder times come, we dance and we celebrate because God is judging us, but his judgment is a judgment of mercy. His judgment is to bring about a new thing. And will we be the remnant that's ready to receive that new thing in joy? Are we going to be bawling because we cannot go up to the 1,000 pencil era? You know what I mean from yesterday. So that's why I think it's important to understand the prophets, because I think understanding the prophets will get us through the next 50 years. Now, again, I may be all wrong. You know, 10 years from now, maybe, but I don't think so. Well, before, are there any comments to that? Do you understand how I'm applying the understanding of the God of history to, mostly the old biblical prophets? You know, taking their understanding of history and applying it today. And then modern prophets, whoever they are, would be doing the same thing today. And it's always the question, who are the prophets? Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. Probably if you'd have a vote during this time, the prophets would not be voted in as the prophets. Right. Now, someone asked about the organization of Isaiah. It's on the board. Okay, you might want to just copy this down so when you read the whole book, you know what parts you're reading. Chapter 1 through 11 are directly Isaiah of Jerusalem during his earlier period. He had really two preaching periods. Chapter 12, hymn of praise added later. 13 to 23, many oracles against the nations, and these came out of the Isaiah school of theology over the years as the Assyrian Empire crumbled and the Babylonian Empire came into power. Then 24 to 27, some eschatological oracles that their style reflects a much later period of time, the time of the Persians, or even possibly the Greek period. This is 24 to 27, maybe the latest writings in the entire book of Isaiah. Then back 28 to 32 is Isaiah's second period of preaching. And then 33 is a late prophetic liturgy or hymn added later. 40 to 55 is a person called Second Isaiah that preaches during the exile period, 587, 538. And then 56 to 66, sometimes called Third Isaiah, but probably a collection of writings of the disciples of Second Isaiah after the return from the Babylonian captivity in 538. Now someone, you know, I'd like here not to get in a discussion, how do we know this? Okay. I would invite you, if you want to check this out in a different a Bible commentary or Bible dictionary, there it explains how scholars have reached these conclusions. Okay, now I'm ready. Want to look at the beginning today a little to the personality of First Isaiah, or the person we call Isaiah of Jerusalem. We know very little about him except his name is Isaiah. He's a preacher. He grew up in what would be called temple piety, a theological understanding that the Davidic kingship and the temple are forever. And that God has promised that he will be with his temple and with his Davidic king forever until the Messianic age. And Isaiah had a wife and kids whom he named strange names like a remnant will return, or God will get everybody. Had different interesting names for his children. Because he confronts the kings, it at one time was thought he was kind of a royal person that had easy access to the court in Jerusalem, but more recently that idea is being challenged. That he was more probably the odd prophet that really had to fight his way to get a hearing from the king. That was a new idea to me. I always thought he was kind of Mr. Royal Prophet who could just knock on the door of the palace and the king would say, come on in. Now, today I want to look at two encounters that Isaiah had with two kings in two different periods of time. The first one will reflect the writings in Isaiah 1 through 11, the period 742 to 732. Just a reminder now that Assyria on our map, capital of Nineveh, is taking over the world and pushing and pushing and pushing against the smaller nations now, especially Syria, Israel, and Judah. Now, the historical context today is, what do we do with Assyria threatening us? And Israel and Syria, and isn't it interesting how contemporary all these words are? Israel and Syria form an alliance together against Assyria. In other words, if we can get our two armies together, maybe we can hold back the Assyrians. And then they said if we could get the southern kingdom, Judah, to join us, then we'll have three nations to combine our armies to fight the Assyrians. And Judah does not want to do that, so they decide to invade Judah and then put a puppet king in Jerusalem that will pull the Judean army into the alliance to keep the Assyrians back. Now, as a background for this, I want to show just 5 or 6 slides, and since there's so few slides, just turn your head, and if only part of the slide gets on the screen, I don't care, but I want to show some pictures that just gives you a feeling of the Assyrians. If you want to see Assyria, you go to London, because during the time of imperialism, the British carried off all of the city of Nineveh to London. And so these are some of the reliefs that you'd see in the British Museum. The first one, this is a picture of Tiglath-Pileser III, the founder of the Assyrian Empire, taking over the world. One thing you'll notice when you see these hundreds of reliefs is nothing to the Syrians is funny. You see, they take their power very seriously, and by looking at their faces, they take their pride and arrogance extremely seriously. You'll never see a smile. And you see there's a feeling in all of these reliefs of just brute power and a very terrorist type of warfare. This is a relief now of Tiglath-Pileser when he invades Syria and Israel. And that's one of the cities that was in Gilead, that's up there on the left, that was invaded now as a punishment to Israel and Syria for forming their alliance against the Assyrians. The dotted line now is the Assyrian Empire. You see how it goes down through the Palestine, and the southern border of it is Egypt. The Assyrians never conquered Egypt. This is a monolith of the Assyrian ruler that followed Tiglath. And this, they would make these pictures of themselves and then tell on their all the glories and wonders of their reign. Again, you see this in the British Museum. Now, in the second period that we'll talk about today is when the Assyrians under Sennacherib, the next Assyrian emperor who invaded now Judah, and this is the siege of Lachish, one of the cities of the southern kingdom that was conquered by the Assyrians, when we'll see today how Hezekiah rebelled against the Assyrians and got it. This is an artist's view of the excuse me artist conception of the Assyrian attack on Lachish. It's the kind of picture you'd like hanging in your living room. Another artist's conception of the Assyrian war machine. Look at these walls now, and then, because I'm going to tell you some feeling statements later about the meaning of an invasion of a city. Just to picture now, this is a picture of the temple, an artist's conception, the Temple of Solomon in Jerusalem. And another artist's conception. The background now of Isaiah 1 through 11, if you want to read in another part of the Bible, 2 Kings 16, 1 through 20. Now, if you look on your time chart, the king now is Ahaz, who is the son of Jotham, who is the son of Uzziah. So Jotham has died, and now we are following the line of David in these kings, Uzziah, Jotham, Ahaz. Oh, thank you. Now, in the book of Kings, the writers of the book of Kings give all of these kings kind of a rating. from 1 to 10, or 0 to 10, and Ahaz gets a 0. If you read the, the writer has a way of just briefly describing what king was a total klutz, and Ahaz won that award. What happened now was when, let's look, or I'll give, for, wait, first I'll give you a little background again of the crisis. Ahaz is in this situation that the Northern Kingdom and Syrian alliance is sieging Judah and Jerusalem. And if you those pictures of cities under siege, you have to feel the terror of having an army surrounding your city and knowing in the next days, weeks, or months, your fate of whether you live or die as a city will be determined by who wins, whether you keep up the defense and they finally give up. You know, and you have to feel the joy of standing up on that wall and seeing the army out there deciding we can't do it and walk away. And you have just, if you can just feel the joy of that moment, and also up until that moment, the unknown, will they break through our walls? Or will they find our water supply? So you have to sense now how frightened Ahaz is. And we get a sense of how frightened he is if we look in Isaiah 7. The first part of Isaiah 7. And the first verse is about how Samaria and Syria now lay siege against Jerusalem. The news was brought to the house of David. Aram, they said, has reached Ephraim. Then the heart of the king and the hearts of the people shuddered as the trees of the forest shudder in front of the wind. In New Mexico and Colorado, we have quaking aspens. Do you know what quaking aspens look like? You know, they just all over. You know, here's a whole city now. A city of quaking leaves or shuddering leaves. And Ahaz, to describe his personality and why he got a rather zero rating in the Book of Kings, he offered his son in a fire sacrifice to Yahweh in order to win Yahweh's favor in keeping the Syrian and Northern Kingdom invasion away. And Yahweh said to Isaiah, go with your son Sher-Jashub, nice name, means a remnant will return. Isaiah named his children so when people would say, what's your kid's name, then he could preach to them. Okay, kind of cool. You know, what's your kid's name? A remnant shall return after the destruction. Then he could go off into a sermon. See? Good idea. He went, that was one of many zero things he did. I'll tell you some more. They're coming up. Okay. Meet Ahaz at the end of the conduit of the upper pool on the Fuller's Field Road. Can't you see there the little sign, Fuller's Field Road? Now this shows that Isaiah didn't have easy access to this king because he has to go find him when the king is going to inspect the water supply. And remember, inspecting the water supply before an invasion was of just prime importance. That was your most vulnerable point in an invasion. So Isaiah finds him by the plumbing. And Isaiah says, pay attention, keep calm, have no fear, do not let your heart sink because of these two smoldering stumps of firebrands. Are you afraid of two stumps that are just kind of in their final fizzle? And you're quaking like a leaf in the forest? Are you actually afraid of these two little nations that are just about at the end of their course? And what happened then after this? Well, I'll go on. Move down to 8. 6 or 5 years more, and a shattered Ephraim, the northern kingdom, shall no longer be a people. But if you do not stand by me, you will not stand at all. And now what Isaiah was worried about or concerned about here is that Ahaz wanted to go around the two northern kingdoms and go directly to Tiglath-Pileser III for protection. And Isaiah said, no, I'll eat you up. And then he comes out with this unrealistic theology that he's going to follow now the rest of his life, and that is, trust in the Lord. It always goes over well with kings who have armies. Trust in the Lord. Okay, so then Isaiah says, moving on in chapter 7, ask Yahweh your God for a sign for yourself, coming either from the depths of Sheol or from the heights above. You know, let's have a little sign and see what God thinks. And then here comes pious Ahaz, who has already made up his mind to go to Assyria and form an alliance with Assyria. No, Ahaz answered, I will not put the Lord Yahweh to the test. And you have to picture him saying this extremely piously. Me, I will not put God to the test. The reason is he already made up his mind and he doesn't want any conflicting evidence. Have you ever made up your mind and then you don't want to listen to any other arguments? Anybody here ever done that? okay. It's like, or you don't want to hear. It's like parents who would don't ask the kids what they did some night because they kind of know what they probably did. You know, you don't want to hear. So Isaiah then comes back and says, well, you don't want a sign, I'm going to give one to you anyway. And you see Ahaz here saying, bug off, I'm checking the water supply. But instead, Isaiah comes back with this verse, or these words. The Lord will give you a sign, and it is this. The maiden is with child and will soon give birth to a son whom she will call Emmanuel, God with us. And our task now for the next 42 seconds is to totally divorce ourselves from Handel's Messiah and from our understanding that this is a prophecy of the coming of Jesus. Isaiah here is not prophecy here, I mean foretelling there, where he is using the word. You know, Isaiah is not now saying, Ahaz, here's a crystal ball and there's going to be a baby born in Bethlehem in a few hundred years. Isaiah here is throwing before Ahaz an argument to not form an alliance with Assyria. And he says, I'll give you a sign. There's a young woman who will have a baby. And when that baby is born, the baby's name will be Emmanuel. And by that time, that baby reaches the age of discretion. The sign is this, that the northern kingdom and Syria are both going to be destroyed nations. So why be afraid of them? There's all kinds of arguments about who this original Emmanuel was that Isaiah is talking about here to Ahaz, but he says a young woman will conceive and bear a son and his name will be called Emmanuel. And then if you follow the text, before he grows up, Israel, the northern kingdom, and Syria will be destroyed. That's the sign. And the name God with us is again Isaiah's whole quote, unrealistic theology in terms of the power structure, and that is trust in the Lord. God is with you. And this is exciting to me because before I looked into this, I'd never heard the historical context of what to us has become our favorite Bible, one of our favorite Old Testament Bible verses. Now I'm at a standstill. I have to look at my notes, see where I am. Okay, then after all of these signs, now Ahaz responds by not listening to Isaiah and going ahead and doing what he wanted to do anyway. And then at this point, when Ahaz doesn't listen to Isaiah, from 732 until 715, 17 years, Isaiah just fades out of the public. But then what happens? Ahaz has this summit meeting with the king of Assyria, Tiglath-Pileser III, in Damascus. And all he has to do now to get protection from Assyria is to give all of the temple treasury over to the Assyrians, become a vassal state, become a servant of Assyria, and then he has to take the exact dimensions of the altar of Holocaust to the Assyrian deity in Damascus, take the exact measurements and rebuild it. And then the fires of Holocaust now before Solomon's temple are no longer burned on the altar of Yahweh, but they are now burned on the altar made for the gods of Assyria. I mean, it was rather minor compromise. I'm saying that sarcastically. I hope you know. And Isaiah's response to this, turn to chapter 8. Chapter 8, verse 5, Yahweh spoke to me again and said, because this people has refused the waters of Shiloh. And the waters of Shiloh was a hidden spring in the city of Jerusalem. Quiet, gentle waters. And to Isaiah, look at the precedence of Jesus using picture language and pointing to different things around him to teach. Isaiah would point to these quiet, gentle waters. He says, because you do not rely on these waters. In other words, it is a way of saying you did not trust in Yahweh, the God of history, to preserve you against the northern kingdom, the Israelite-Syrian alliance, because you did not do that. Instead of this quiet, gentle stream of God's peace, you're going to get a flood. You'll get a flood. Listen. Because this people has refused the waters of Shiloh, which flow in tranquility and trembles before Rezin and the son of Remaliah, the Lord will bring up against you the mighty and deep waters of the river. And then a later editor was afraid people wouldn't understand, so he adds, the king of Assyria and all his glory. And it will overflow out of its bed, bursting all its banks. It will inundate Judah, flow over, pour out, flooding upon the neck, and its wings will spread over the whole breadth of your country, O Emmanuel. Know this, peoples, you will be crushed, and so on. So this was his first encounter with the king. And Isaiah is not listened to, but then he says, instead of the gentle water, you're going to get flooded by the Assyrians. Okay, Judah now becomes a vassal state of Assyria. So the dotted line of the Assyrian emperor now takes Jerusalem. Also, 10 years later, Isaiah's prediction about Samaria and Damascus happened when they were both... They were both conquered by Assyria, and then that was the end of what we call the 10 tribes of Israel. That was the end of Israel. Now, a beautiful word of hope. Remember how we talked last time about how Isaiah always brings in a word of hope. Look at chapter 9. The people that walked in darkness has seen a great light. And if there ever was a time of darkness now for this nation, it's now. Our national identity is really over. We are a vassal state. We have an altar to the Assyrian god right in our temple. And then we have still the threat of Assyria. We are a conquered people now, really, in essence, or a vassal state. And then they can still remember the former glory during the time of Uzziah, at least in their family histories, and it's all over now. The people that walked in darkness, but what do they see? A great light. On those who live in a land of deep shadow, a light has shone. And then moving down, for the yoke that was weighing on him, the bar across his shoulders, the rod of his oppressor, those you break as on the day of Midian. And Midian is the word for Gideon's battle. Remember, Gideon won the battle by breaking a few lamps and screaming. And catch that and hold it on the shelf, because Isaiah, through these two encounters with the king, is going to struggle through the final understanding that again became the life of Jesus Christ, that God's people live in this world by nonviolence. Then what is the sign of hope or the future hope? Down to verse 5. For there is a child born to us, a son given to us, and dominion is laid on his shoulders, and this is the name they will give him: Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, the Eternal Father, Prince of Peace. Wide is his dominion in a peace that has no end, for the throne of David and for his royal power, which he establishes and makes secure in justice and integrity. From this time onwards and forever, the jealous love of Yahweh Sabaoth will do this. Again, divorce yourself from Handel's Messiah. And Isaiah is here taking all of the great attributes of the heroes of Israel and gathering them all into one person, and is saying that the line of David will move to a Savior King who will establish peace and justice. Now, I hope this is exciting to you, to put these favorite texts into their historical context. Now, that hope of the coming God hero then ends Isaiah's encounter and flop, you might say, with King Ahaz. But notice how his life is moved forward not by failure or success, but by the vision of God's future. Okay. Now, I want to spend the last time moving up the 17 years to the next king, Hezekiah. What did Isaiah do now during the 17 year period in between? Probably he withdrew and taught his disciples. In other words, this was really the seminary period. I'm phasing out for a while to set up the curriculum of the seminary. But then another thing happens now under the reign of Hezekiah that we want to look at now, that will bring me to where I want to move today. But before we go that any, I want to, which was the world power at this time. I think I made a mistake yesterday that I connected Assyria with modern day Iran. Be more correct to connect modern Iran with Persia in the ancient world. Needed to correct that. Any other?
Modern day Assyria.
When these empires took over the world, they were all from this Fertile Crescent, that they had their kind of, I think there were more ethnic groups that came into power. So Assyria was centered in Nineveh. Yeah, I think the ruins of Nineveh today would be in Iran, am I right? Does anybody know geography?
Iraq.
Or is it Iraq? Okay. Then the capital of later Persia was, forgot the name of the town, but that would be modern Iran. Because Iraq is this way today, it's in Iran. Americans, the Chris last week, we were talking about how Americans know almost nothing about geography, about world geography. Then I'm upset when a foreign person does not know where New Mexico is. I have to tell them it's next to Texas. Well, any other comments? We move on. Okay, moving right along. Now I have to find again where my notes are. That was for your interest. I just finished page 4. And I'm moving on to page 5. No, I'm moving to the second part of page 4. No, you were all wondering. And now if we look back at our time chart again, I'll explain the next historical situation. A new thing happens now on the left of our chart, so move over to the left, is that during the time of Ahaz, Egypt was in decline, and now at the time of Hezekiah, beginning in 715, Egypt again assumes world power or strength as a world power with the coming of what's now called the 25th dynasty. So now a new political situation is that Judah is caught between Egypt to the south and the Assyria to the north. Now Hezekiah gets a rather plus rating from the writers of Kings because Hezekiah brings about a religious reformation. He was a wise leader until finally he doesn't listen to Isaiah. None of them listened to Isaiah, but in spite of that, he was a wise leader and a vigorous leader. A lucky thing happened, and a lot of this had to do with either luck or God, depending on how you want to look at it, that Assyria was all of a sudden busy to the north, and all of a sudden that takes pressure off of Judah. And while the Assyrian armies are busy other places, we can kind of get things together here at home. And so that is what Hezekiah does. He renews Yahweh religion. He prepares the way, really, for the later, what were later called the Deuteronomic reforms. And along with that, he stimulates, again, a sense of nationalism. Now that the Assyrians are busy some other place, we can get our own nation together in a new sense of national identity. Okay, now then on your chart, you'll notice the Assyrian emperor now is Sargon II. You'll notice on the chart he is involved in campaigns to the north and east, which, as I said, allows Judah to get things together. Then Sargon dies in 705. And whenever something happens to the biggest guy, all the littler guys say, now maybe we can rebel now and get away with it. So Babylon tries a rebellion, and then other nations see if we can now rebel against the Assyrians. And Hezekiah now makes his big mistake, and he says, I know what I'll do. I'll join up with Egypt in an alliance against Assyria. And now comes Isaiah out of his seminary to find the king again to say, no. And that's what we'll look at now.
How did Egypt come back into power?
I don't know enough about the history of Egypt. there was the beginning of a dynasty called the 25th dynasty, which was an Ethiopian dynasty that, I don't know, somehow got Egypt together again. I'd have to study that, or any of us could study that separately, but I'm not sure. But what I do know is some way, with the rise of this new dynasty in Egypt, it again becomes a power in the ancient world to reckon with. Now, if we'll open our book now to Isaiah 30. Isaiah 30, "Woe to those rebellious sons, it is Yahweh who speaks. There carry out plans that are not mine, and make alliances not inspired by me, and so add sin to sin. They have left for Egypt without even consulting me." "To take refuge in Pharaoh's protection, to shelter in Egypt's shadow, a picture a hurting lover." You know, the lover God is saying, "I'll protect you under my wings." But instead you're going off to Pharaoh. "Pharaoh's protection will be your shame, the shelter of Egypt's shadow you're confounding. For his ministers have gone to Zoan, his ambassadors have already reached Hanes." I'm not sure if that's pronounced right. "All are carrying gifts to a nation that will be of no use to them, that will bring them neither aid nor help, nothing but shame and disgrace." And Hezekiah's response is to go to Egypt and form the alliance. And then comes this powerful new understanding that Isaiah has, that the security of this nation is not with military might. Move from in chapter 30 down to verse 16. "No," you will say, "we will flee on horses." You know, so what if the Assyrians come? You know, the Egyptians are going to give us horses and chariots, and they're going to give us all kinds of stuff. "So be it then," and you add, "in swift chariots." "So be it, your pursuers will be swift too." Then move to chapter 31. "Woe to those who go down to Egypt to seek help there." I want to pull us up to the present now as we read this and look at both places. In 1981, the United States spent $153.7 billion on arms to make ourselves secure. $153.7 billion on arms. You know, now it's going to be more. The date I had was 81. And feel that number, or feel the fact that I also read, I don't know how this statistic comes, I think from Ron Sider, if 0.5% of 1 year's world military expenditure were used on food production, the countries that are hungry would have self-sustaining food production possibly by 1990. 0.5% of what the world seeks for its security. Then ask yourself, are we more secure now than we were 20 years ago? Are we? "Woe to those who go down to Egypt to seek help there, who build their hopes on cavalry, who rely on the number of chariots and on the strength of mounted men, but never look to the Holy One of Israel nor consult their lover, Yahweh." And then he goes on, "The Egyptian is a man, not a god. His horses are flesh, not spirit. Yahweh will stretch out his hand to make the protector stumble. The protected will fall, and all will perish together." And then down to verse 5, then, like hovering birds. If you're in Jerusalem in the evening, you see in the evening setting sun, birds just hovering over the city. You see that today. Like hovering birds, so will Yahweh Sabaoth protect Jerusalem. He will protect it, rescue it, spare it, and save it. Come back to the one you have so wickedly betrayed. Come back to your lover. Well, those are some passages in the context. Now I want to tell you, close today by telling you what happened. Because Hezekiah went to Egypt for help. The response of Assyria was to send an invading army into Judah. And you can read on these plaques that the Assyrian kings made when they report all their successes. The king of Assyria says on the plaque that you can read in the British Museum today if you know Assyrian. It's actually on a cylinder. You have to walk around to read it. 46 cities in Judah I conquered. One was Lachish that we saw on the slide. And then he said, Hezekiah, I shut up like a bird in the cage. Hezekiah, I shut up like a bird in the cage. And he did. Because now the drama is, the armies of Assyria now have conquered and captured 46 cities in Judah, and now they surround and they siege Jerusalem. And now Hezekiah is up there, and somehow Isaiah's got next to him, so he's standing there by his side. And Isaiah keeps saying, don't surrender, don't surrender, don't surrender. And then something happens that's going to determine many ways that Isaiah thinks and the people think from this time forth. The siege of Jerusalem is almost completed. Almost completed. The war is almost over. Jerusalem is almost almost defeated. And they're all standing looking over the wall, and all of a sudden the Assyrian army packs up, folds up their tents, and goes home. Isaiah, for the historical reason, the Judean tradition, the reason for this was that Yahweh sent a plague and they were getting so sick and sick to their stomach that they said, let's go home. Probably the actual reason was that the Assyrians heard about more important problems on their northern and eastern borders. And Jerusalem and Judea were kind of a two-bit mountain nation that wasn't that important. So we don't want to expend any more effort sieging this city, so let's pack up and get to where more important battles are to be fought and won. But whatever the case, or whatever the reason, they left. And all of a sudden, the Judeans in Jerusalem are just looking at each other in total disbelief. And now, after this, Isaiah goes back to his seminary, packs up and goes back to his books. The folk wisdom now is this that follows. God will always take care of his temple, her city. Will always be cared about. We never have to worry. Isaiah, what did he think of this? Because number one, his problem was he said, trust in the Lord and the Lord will take care of you. And it ended up with, they didn't trust in the Lord and the Lord took care of them. That would be called a crisis of faith. What I think now is will be happening now as Isaiah goes back to the books. One, Isaiah has come to understand and has come to believe, and this now will be implanted in the school of Isaiah, that God's people live by trust and not by violence. And this will be the struggle of Jesus in the temptation in the wilderness. And I want to pull us towards that point, because I believe Jesus was a continuation of the Isaiah seminary. And what Isaiah works out here is God's people do not live by the sword, but they live by trust. He is still at the point, at this point, if we trust in God, God will take care of us. And we'll find that the Isaiah seminary has to mature beyond this point. Also, during the next years, now probably Isaiah begins to free himself from his temple piety, meaning that God will always take care of his temple. And he'll begin to formulate a theology that says the new temple is the people, the faithful remnant, an idea that will be picked up in the exile now after the destruction of the temple by 2nd Isaiah.